Thank you. Hi, I'm Tariq Bhatt. I am a postdoc in immunology, and I'm going to teach you angiogenesis and metastasis process. So, this first slide, what is the role of angiogenesis? What does it do? You can see it's a mass of tissue, a tumor. It cannot grow without recruitment of capillaries beyond its size limit. It attains the size, after that, it will not recruit any growth. It secretes some chemoattractant molecules, they invite, attract nearby blood vessels, then they infiltrate into the tumor, and tumor grows beyond capacity. So this is basic angiogenesis. Formation of new blood vessels, capillaries from the pre-existing ones, that's what is called as angiogenesis. So it involves sprouting of new vessels from already ones, splitting and remodeling of those vessels which are formed from pre-existing ones. And why is it important? Angiogenesis is important because it supplies oxygen and nutrients to tissues and organs. Without blood capillaries reaching to all tissues, they cannot support their growth. That's why tissue dies when there is ischemia or there is hypoxia. So essentiality of recruitment of these blood vessels in the tissues is as important as soul in a body. So it is also important when there is metabolism in the tissue and cells are growing and they have to remove the waste products, they have to remove their noxious substances. That's what blood capillaries do. They take away waste from those tissues and dispose them through a system. It is also important because tumor growth cannot be supported beyond a certain size limit without recruitment of these blood vessels. Because tumors are actively growing and they need much food, so involvement of angiogenesis is very important. This is the basic process of angiogenesis. Small, nascent, new capillaries arise from the pre-existing vessels. So, briefly, I will go through with you first some basic aspects of what is angiogenesis. They are all same aspects of angiogenesis, but differently put. So, vascular genesis, then the embryo grows, when there is embryo growth. So, in the embryo, there are very limited number of cells and there are no blood vessels. They grow to a size limit, after that they stop growing. Because when a cell mass grows, there will be always in the core hypoxia, and hypoxia induces pro-androgenic factors like HIF-1 alpha and vascular endothelial factors. They change the course of future embryonic growth. When embryo reaches beyond 16 cell stage, there are stem cells called angioblasts, and those angioblasts give differentiation into endothelial cells, which you can see here. And these endothelial cells are the major players of any vasculature afterwards. So this is the primary vasculature, which is being built up through vascular genesis. And angiogenesis is encompassing all these phenomena. So angiogenesis basically means all the phenomena leading to growth of any capillary or vessel from pre-existing ones or from stem cells. And this is just different from arteriogenesis, growth of arteries or lymphogenesis or formation of lymphatic vasculature. So this is how angiogenesis is important in various aspects. For example, during the embryo growth. So it's important because it supplies food and removes waste from the growing embryo. And in adult life, if there's injury or in the menstrual cycle in males, there's also angiogenesis going on. And in tumors, mainly in solid tumors, without angiogenesis, they cannot support the growth and they cannot grow and they cannot disseminate and they cannot make metastatic lesions. So in health and disease, angiogenesis is very important. So this is the primitive angiogenesis going on in embryo. You can see here the vascular genesis, artery and vein, they form from angioblasts. Angioblasts are the stem cell precursors which are originating from actually human germplasms, and they have the capacity to transform and differentiate into endothelial cells, and endothelial cells are precursors of all the angiogenesis of all the capillaries and vessels. So this is called angiogenic remodeling within the embryo, and it goes through many stages and various factors, including VGF, which is vascular endothelial growth factor, which is very important for angiogenesis. It is called a pro-angiogenic molecule, and this is the main target of any anti-tumor or anti-angiogenic therapy which is in clinic right now. So this is what is going on in the early embryo. The hemangioblasts are some cells of the embryo, because embryo has a small size, and they are all stem cells, and some stem cells in there are called hemangioblasts, which is the multipotent hematopoietic stem cell, and all the other cell types in the body derive from these hemangioblasts. They give rise to all the cell types, and especially they give rise to angioblasts, which are stem cell precursors for future endothelial cells. And from the endothelial cells, then they reorganize, they proliferate, and they branch and form capillaries and vessels. So this is the basic structure of a capillary or vessel. So this is lumen of artery, for example, where blood flows, and it is surrounded by the basal lamina, which is a layer of endothelial cells, and it is protected by various layers of fibers and tissues, especially smooth muscle cells, which are called as pericytes. And pericytes are very important in the texture, organization, and intactness of any capillary, vessel, or artery. So basically, there are four major steps of angiogenesis process. The first step is breaking through our basal lamina. So if you can see here, this is the resting artery, vessel, or capillary. How will angiogenesis process be accomplished from a single artery, vessel, or capillary? So it's this layer is basal lamina, and it's mainly found of a single layer of endothelial cells. So these endothelial cells, if they have to give rise to new capillaries, new vessels, they have to break these walls. That's what I mean. So breaking through the basal lamina that envelops existing blood vessels. Then, when they break through the basal lamina, they have to migrate towards outer side. And this migration is not random, it is specific to signals. For example, signals arising from surrounding tissues, they secrete, for example, there is injury, there is a wound, and then that there needs to be wound healing. So wound healing is a regulatory process. In wound healing, the first important factors are chemoattracting molecules, for example, vascular endothelial growth factor, which is secreted in the course of bone, and that bone, after secretion of VGF or BRGF, attracts these endothelial cells, and they migrate towards signal. So greater the source of signal, more the migration towards that. So when the source is bone, so these endothelial cells migrate to bone, and they start healing process, and they recruit new capillaries and vessels in the boning area and involved in bone healing. Then there they proliferate, cell division. Without cell division, endothelial cell cannot make any vessel, any capillary, because cell division is prerequisite for vessel or capillary growth. Then after they proliferate, they have to organize themselves into tubes and capillaries. So that's called reorganization, or organization of these endothelial cells into tubes or capillaries. This is very important process, the fourth one. Without that organization, there will be immature vessels, they will die, they will be prone to surrounding tissues, harsh environment. So formation of tubes is very critical, and the last step of this process. So you can see how a resting endothelial cell, and when there is a stimulus, for example, a bone or a tumor or injury or menstruation, there are these factors, they are pro-angiogenic factors, VGF or BRGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, this is the prime, main angiogenic factor, and the second one is BFGF, basic fibroblast growth factor. They are chemoattractive molecules then they are released in the system, in the bone, tumor. They attract these endothelial cells. After attraction, they bind to cognitive respective receptors and start a cascade of signaling pathways. And that signaling pathways, they are important in breaking the walls of vessel. For example, when VEGF binds to its receptor, it binds to VEGFR, and VEGFR starts in the tyrosine kinase receptor, and downstream signaling is inducing MMPs, which matrix metalloproteinases, and these matrix metalloproteinases, they dissolve the surrounding tissue so that this resting endothelial cell will move out of the vessel, so they came up on the vessel. And after this stage, they start formation of branch points and start proliferating. After proliferation, they start organization into capillaries, vessels, and their final interconnection fixes the vessel or capillary growth. And these stages are supported by different factors within the tumor microenvironment, or within the injury, or within the site of angiogenesis. So what is the lifetime of endothelial cells, which are the major players of this process? So some are surviving months, for example lung, liver, some years, for example brain, muscle. Normal angiogenesis process, normal vessel formation is in the resting state. In the adult life, this process of angiogenesis is very slow, and there is only need when there is injury or when there is some physiological stimulus like menstruation, or there is a disease aspect, for example tumor growth. They only affect angiogenesis positively when in adult life there are effects of injury, wound healing, or tumor development. Now, new muscle formation is always in embryo, in growth to adulthood, in child, in young ones which have to grow to adulthood. There's excessive growth because everything is building up, everything is moving in 3D structure, and in menstrual cycle there is also angiogenesis, bone repair, but they all are in the healthy states. But this is the tumor angiogenesis, this is the disease state, and in disease state the tumors, they essentially recruit endothelial cells, capillaries from surrounding tissues, so that they can support their own growth. Otherwise they will die, because they need food, they need to remove waste, so that they're highly active tumors. So they need angiogenesis as importantly as any other tissue. So there are basically two, how angiogenesis is affected, how this process is mediated. So physiologically, there are two aspects. One is sprouting angiogenesis. Sprouting means there's a capillary, there's a vessel, there's a artery, and there will be sprouting, outward sprouting of a vessel. There is another aspect of intrasusceptive angiogenesis, which is invagination towards a vessel. So how these processes are affected, I'll show you here. So this is a typical sprouting process, and this is a vessel capillary, and the resting endothelial cells, in response to angiogenic factors, they start moving towards edges and sprout new capillaries, and they form new vessels. Here in non-sprouting angiogenesis, which is also called intersusceptive vascularization, these endothelial cells, they branch inward and grow and elongate and form new vessels or capillaries. So why this sprouting or branching is important? Because when there's a need, for example, this endothelial cell, this has been chemo-attracted by a neighborhood, which is bone, which is injury, or which is a tumor here, and that tumor or bone or injury needs to support its growth. So they secrete endogenic factors and they attract them, and then after attraction they make capillaries. Now you can see the RBC, blood flow, will go into that organ and support the growth. That's why it's important in health and disease. So it is the retina of an embryonic mouse. You can see the capillaries. This is the GFP green fluorescent label, because GFP is a protein which is green fluorescently labeled, and when it's excited it gives green fluorescence, and you can use it as a tracker molecule in any biological process. Oh, sorry.
So do adults have any of those
Because endothelial cells itself, they are, I told you, endothelial cells itself, they are only in the adulthood. I mean, in the embryo, in childhood. In adult life, endothelial cells, I mean, you have injury, why you heal? It's because of those endothelial cells. They are only, they act like stem cell like cells. If you remove endothelial cells in culture, I have done that, and they behave like stem cells. But only when you provide them proper factors like VEGF, VFGF, or any other tissue extract, they grow, they proliferate, they make capillaries on the plate. If you have basal membrane, if you have matrigel, if you have tissue matrix, and you lay endothelial cells on them, then you provide signal, they branch. So they act as stem cells. So there is no need, and there is not, you know, but it's only in the embryo stage when there is a need. So in adult life, any endothelial cell has potential to proliferate, to make vessels, given opportunities. So this is in retina of embryonic mouse, which has been labeled with GFP, and you can see the fluorescence and branching of these vessels. This is just to show you. So what are the activators of angiogenesis? There are various activators. You can see here, lot of activators, proteins and small molecules as well. But most important of all these factors, which positively affect angiogenesis, is vascular endothelial growth factor. Currently, angiogenesis in cancer biology is a hot topic because almost all, I mean not all people, majority of the therapies which are given to patients, they target angiogenesis. So, and this has been studied tremendously, and people are doing all their clinical trials on their cancer drugs or antibodies, and then they start looking for what is the effect on angiogenesis, whether they will stop growth of tumor. Because angiogenesis in adult life, I told you, in adult life there is no need of angiogenesis, only except in wound healing, only except when there is no adult, you know, female menstrual cycle, or when there is a tumor growth. Because tumors cannot grow when there is a tumor metastasis. So tumors are in the body, so they grow. They can grow only up to 3 millimeter size. Normally, that's called a benign tumor. And benign tumors are, I mean, everybody has benign tumor. All of us have benign tumor. They don't, you know, grow like that. They remain latent for years, decades. Or they don't grow in lifetime. But only when there's a recruitment of a blood vessel, capillary, into the tumor, it grows and it leads to metastasis, because they can be disseminated to any target, any organ in the body. That's why this process is important. And the vascular endothelial growth factor is prime pro-angiogenic factor, and many clinical trials are targeting this molecule, this protein. It's a soluble factor protein, and it binds to its cognitive receptor, VEGF-A, receptor R1, R2, and R3, and it has various forms like VEGF-A, B, C, D, but VEGF-B, VEGF-2 is important, but VEGF-A is important, and VEGF-R2 receptor is important. The role of it. So, I will tell you later what is hypoxia doing with angiogenesis, but you should know that it is under the control of hypoxia inducible factor. Hypoxia inducible factor is HIF-1 alpha and beta. That's the transcription factor which regulates VEGF production on the promoters. So, VEGF receptor expression is upregulated under hypoxia or ischemic conditions. So early involvement of VEGF in the process is very important. So this is just, I told you all about this. But now, important thing is that what VEGF does, it induces vasodilation via endothelial NO production. So you might be knowing that what nitric oxide does to vasodilation. Nitric oxide, you know, binds to guanylyl cyclase and then produces pyrophosphate and CGMP, I mean cyclic guanylyl monophosphate. That binds to myosin, and myosin phosphorylation leads to leaky wall, I mean relaxation state of myosin, gives you the vasodilation. Because myosin is the fibril that's binding to walls of capillaries. So NO production, I mean nitric oxide induces vasodilation, and that's what, you know, VEGF does. And vasodilation is important for sprouting of vessels. Otherwise, if the vessel is intact, it's not dilated, it's not leaky, it is very tough. It cannot lead to sprouting. Sprouting is very important and easy if there is vasodilation. If there is a tenderness in the vessel. If it's tough, it's not supporting the sprouting. So for that matter, animal production is important, and VEGF does that. And also VEGF, it induces vascular permeability. What does it mean, inducing vascular permeability? It makes endothelial cell movements very easy, and it also makes them accessible to other factors in the vicinity. So this is all how the same as VEGF, what it does to angiogenesis. And you can see here. So you might be knowing chorioallantoic membrane on the eggs. Eggs have four membranes, and if you have seen developing embryo in the egg, they from day zero to onwards, day three, day four. I have done this actually myself. That's what I'm saying. So if you see a developing embryo, you can see after days, these capillaries, these vessels growing much denser and much clearer and much reddish. So when they grow, with growth they produce VEGF. From day zero there is less VEGF. From day zero onwards the VEGF production is more and more, and that's why you see more growth here. But this is in vitro. I took the membrane out of the vessel, of the egg, and put in culture, and then you can add serum-free media. Serum-free media is just base media, there is no growth factor. And then if you add VEGF to serum-free media, you can see how tremendously it supports the growth of these, you know, vessels. So that means it's the part to regulate it off. It's just for demonstration that it supports vessel growth. This is the VEGF family and it is receptors. Like I can say that VEGF A, B, C and D, and how they bind their cognate receptors. But important of all these is VEGF A and VEGF R2. And you can see these, they are all tyrosine kinase receptors. What tyrosine kinase receptors do is, after they bind their receptors, after they bind their ligand, the tyrosine kinase activities increase and they stimulate downstream adaptor proteins, phosphorylate them, and then induce a signaling cascade downstream which affects growth, proliferation and survival of endothelial cells. I will show you here. This is endothelial cell, this is plasma membrane, and this is VEGF R, VEGF receptor. After binding of vascular endothelial receptor to its receptor, it induces tyrosine kinase activity of its cytoplasmic domain, which activates many pathways. For example, PIC kinase pathways, JAK2 pathways, PLC, PKC, RAF1, MEK pathway. All these pathways lead to angiogenesis, or if not angiogenesis, they support endothelial cell proliferation, survival, migration, and invasion, which all are important, because endothelial cell proliferation is as important as survival, as important as migration. Because without migration and invasion, they cannot reorganize the capillaries. So all the processes downstream of VEGF are important in supporting new vessel growth. So here is, now we know that VEGF is very important in angiogenesis. Now, this regulation upstream and downstream. So these are the upstream factors which are regulating VEGF positively, and what VEGF does to its receptor, and finally leads to angiogenesis. So this is just, I think you should know all this. This is important. So what is the role of hypoxia? I was talking about hypoxia. Now it's important, hypoxia. So there's a thing called angiogenic switch. Angiogenesis cannot be random. It cannot be like, okay, now a body has to grow capillaries. It's only in disease, you know, state when there is random proliferation of capillaries, vessels. Like we have moles, red moles, so that's a bunch of capillaries growing. That's not normal. Or we have bones, or some bones don't heal properly. There is excessive angiogenesis, like psoriasis. So there's a problem. But in normally adult life, it is regulated, it's not random. So there is one thing called angiogenic switch. What is that switch? That means why resting endothelial cells will proliferate, will migrate, will invade tissues and make capillary vessels. What is that switch? That switch is mainly the production, abundance and availability of vascular endothelial growth factor plus other pro-angiogenic factors like BFGF, or hypoxia. Now, as I told you, vascular endothelial growth factor is under the direct control of hypoxia inducible factor, and hypoxia inducible factor is having two components.
hypoxia infiltrator alpha and HIF-1 beta. So HIF-1 alpha and HIF-1 beta, then they bind, they make active oxygen factor, it goes into nucleus, it binds the promoter region of VEGF gene and affects VEGF production, mRNA production, and that leads to VEGF protein synthesis and angiogenesis. But HIF-1 alpha and HIF-1 beta dynamicity is important, because HIF-1 alpha is under normal oxygen concentrations, it is not stable. I'll show you.
So hypoxia and angiogenesis, they are interlinked and they are dependent, and without hypoxia, angiogenesis cannot be supported. So I talked earlier about the embryonic development. In embryonic development, I told you, when the embryo grows from single cell, zygote, then multi-celled, at a certain stage, it assumes a growth. I'll tell you one thing. In adulthood or in growing embryo or growing child, no tissue can be supported without capillaries, without active blood supply, beyond 3 millimeter size of diameter of tissue. So only 3 millimeter diameter size tissue will grow by diffusion, because oxygen, CO2, any gas, they will be diffused properly, there will be no problem, and food molecules, glucose, they will enter that size limit. So this size limit of 3 millimeter is important. If it has to grow beyond this 3 millimeter size, that there has to be active blood supply. And active blood supply will only be possible when there is angiogenesis. Now, after when the 3 millimeter size is attained, in the core of this 3 millimeter size limit tissue or organ or tumor, there is a hypoxia, because on the surface is normoxia, is in the vicinity. When you go to the core, there is hypoxia, because towards the core of the ball there will be no oxygen, because it is dense mass of cell, and in the core there is hypoxia, there is no oxygen, and in that core HIF-1 alpha and HIF-1 beta become active, because under normoxia HIF-1 alpha is unstable. That's why in early embryonic development, I told you, beyond certain cell stage, angiogenesis is important, otherwise it will grow, and many embryos, they don't survive, there's no conception, conceiving, because there is defect in angiogenesis. So that's one important point. So this is what is angiogenic switch, and this is the basic process of angiogenesis at molecular level. You can see, this is HIF-1 alpha. I told you HIF-1 alpha and HIF-1 beta here. If they bind, they make intact transcription factor. It goes into nucleus and binds to HIF-1 responsive elements, for example, VEGF gene, and then induces VEGF mRNA expression, and then it goes down and makes protein. But how this HIF-1 alpha is regulated? Under normoxia, when there is normal oxygen concentration, the prolyl hydroxylase is active. So this enzyme oxygen dependently hydroxylates HIF-1 alpha. So hydroxylation of HIF-1 alpha by this enzyme is dependent on oxygen. When there is abundant oxygen, this enzyme hydroxylates HIF-1 alpha. After hydroxylation of HIF-1 alpha, it binds VHL. VHL is one Hybel Lindau protein. So it binds to hydroxylated HIF-1 alpha. After VHL binds to hydroxylated HIF-1 alpha, it binds to ubiquitin, and ubiquitin leads to degradation. So this under normoxia will not be available, because under normoxia this goes down this pathway, it's degradation. Although there is always, homeostasis of expression of HIF-1 alpha, but the moment it's produced, it is degraded under normoxia. So in hypoxia, for example, I told you in the tumor's core, in the embryonic core, this hypoxia, there is no oxygen. That means this will not be active, because prolyl hydroxylase only hydroxylates under oxygen conditions. When there is no oxygen, this will not be hydroxylated. So it is not hydroxylated, it will be available in abundance and bind to HIF-1 beta, and it will lead to VEGF expression. So VEGF expression, after VEGF expression is build up in the core of tumor or in the core of embryo, that's the signal for surrounding endothelial cells to move towards the signal, because the core is having high production of VEGF
towards surface. So it's like the, there is more VGF in the core than in surface. So endothelial cells will migrate towards core in a chemo attraction. So if you,
I know, I'm sure you know about the chemo attraction. So it's normal chemotactic process. So chemotactically, endothelial cells target to the core and infiltrate there, proliferate, because VGF is everything to them. It is their survival, it is their proliferative capacity, it induces their reorganization, it is multifactorial agent for antigenesis. So if you have any question here, you can tell me now. This is very important. It can be an exam. Yeah.
So is this saying that normoxia, the
HIF1
alpha,
the pro-HIF1 alpha, gets hydroxylated and then that targets it for degradation? So yes. So
it's not like it's expressed
when... No, it's expressed. It is regulated only at ubiquitin level, at degradation level. What's your question?
Okay,
yeah. The HIF1 alpha is regulated only at degradation level, not at production level. It produces normally. Yeah, only at this level it is regulated. When it binds to ubiquitin through VHL, and VHL will only bind hydroxylated HIF1 alpha, and hydroxylated HIF1 alpha is only possible under normoxia. So under hypoxia there will be no hydroxylation because this enzyme is not capable of hydroxylating this without oxygen.
Is the oxygen sensor, slowly. Alright, next.
Now, I was talking about the chemo attraction, chemotactic movement, and density or concentration of VGF. See, this is the vessel. Blood flows through. So, the first abundant concentration of oxygen will be here, right? Close to the artery. So, the moment it goes towards this, there is low oxygen level, see. And that's where it is always there. Because endothelial cells, I told you already, there is a lifespan, like I told you, 2 months and some years, and they die, there's a turnover. Where they proliferate, they don't proliferate here. They proliferate away from oxygen. That's where their turnover is. They are the newest ones, they are the older ones. When they die, they go out and they form new ones here. Because they are under hypoxia here, comparatively to this region. And the same as how this transcription factor binds. And HIF1 beta is stable. So HIF1 beta is nothing to do with anything. It's only HIF1 alpha which is regulatory. See, okay. See how this is HIF1 responsive element. How many pathways it induces after this transcription factor binds to the responsive elements? For example, VGF, Ang2, is Ang2 angiopoietin. Angiopoietin are the pro-angiogenic factors. They bind to thyroid receptors, and they, after binding to thyroid receptors, and thyroid receptor TIE, thyroid receptor acts like a VGF receptor, and then affects. And see how it induces NOS. NOS is nitric oxide synthase. So this is enzyme which synthesizes nitric oxide, and after its synthesis, it leads to vasodilation. Vascular permeability, that is very important for angiogenesis. And PDGF, platelet derived growth factor B, that's also inducing angiogenesis by supporting endothelial growth and also supporting VGF expression. Glycolysis, see how they induce glycolysis is important. Because within the tumor mass, then there is, or within the embryo, when there is high expression of VGF, then they have support their growth. So if glycolysis is active, that means they will grow more and more.
So it is a multifactorial, I told you, multifactorial aspect. That's why von Hippel-Lindau protein is considered as tumor suppressor. Because if it is mutated, it will have a problem. Because von Hippel-Lindau protein is actually inhibiting angiogenesis. That's why in many chemotherapeutic strategies or clinical trials, this is also a target, because this leads to sequestration of HIF1 alpha and inhibits angiogenesis. You can see here how they regulate different aspects and then lead to either angiogenesis or no angiogenesis. Now, then there is excess and illnesses. There are diseases which are regulated by excess. And then there is deficiency. So cancer is one of the main cases where antigen is very high, because almost all tumors, they are androgenic. They cannot grow, they cannot spread, they cannot resize if there is no active blood supply. That's why different therapeutic aspects are against tumor vasculature. And if there's deficiency, you can have ischemia or myocardial ischemia or ischemia, so that is also dangerous. This is about androgen inhibitors. How, for example, this is, how there's a balance. When there's a bone healing, when there's under normal homeostasis, there has to be balance. When the bone heals properly, there's no need that it should be, the process should go on. So there is a regulation of this process. So these are the activators. That means they will induce angiogenesis. But there has to be a feedback. And these are the inhibitors which act against these activators and bring it back. So there's a fine balance. If this balance is disturbed, that will determine the fate of the angiogenesis course. When there are more, the angiogenesis is more. When the inhibitors are more, it will turn this off. So that's how it is acting. And importantly here, I made, you know, highlighted TSP, it is thrombosporin. It is very important and it's an inhibitor of angiogenesis. And it affects migration, survival, and growth of endothelial cells. And leads to apoptosis, finally, through FAS-L and FAS-ligand. I don't know FAS, how they got this independent cell death. I'll give you these slides later, no problem. So this is a list of angiogenesis inhibitors, and angiostatin and endostatin, interferons, they are main inhibitors of angiogenesis. Primarily angiostatin and endostatin, they are very important in inhibiting, and they are used in therapeutic models also. Even in nature, some phytochemicals, some natural, you know, some plants are also used as inhibitors of angiogenesis. Endostatin is naturally occurring, so it inhibits BFGF and VGF growth factors. Endostatin is also natural inhibitor found within the body. I was talking about tumor angiogenesis, how tumor angiogenesis is affecting, how angiogenesis is affecting tumor growth. So Judah Folkman was the first one. This guy was the first one to support through his research that angiogenesis is prerequisite for tumor growth and muscular culture. And he said that, postulated, if we have to inhibit tumor growth and it is spread, we have to target this process through angio prevention. Now I'll show you the previous slide here. This is tumor, localized, benign, and within the core is hypoxia. They start secreting these molecules, and these molecules are acting as chemoattractant. After they acting as chemoattractant, they will attract these endothelial cells in the pre-existing capillaries, and it will go inside the tumor mass, and it will grow and spread to other organs. Now we can understand this better. So similarly, in tumor, I told you already, size limit is 1 to 2 millimeter. Beyond that, there has to be active supply of blood, active supply of oxygen and food, otherwise there will be no growth. So hypoxia is the angiogenic switch, because within the core there is hypoxia. It induces VGF production through HIFN alpha stabilization and binding to HIFN beta. So I told you all this. This is a normal, I mean not normal, actually. This is the process how tumor metastasis is affected positively. This is a normal cell. After normal cell is initiated, there is dysplasia. Sorry, oh, I didn't see you.
I understand why the inside of the tumor doesn't grow, right? But why doesn't the outside keep growing? Because the outside does have access to oxygen and nutrients. So,
what's that?
Well, I understand why the inside of the tumor doesn't grow, because it lacks oxygen and nutrients, right? right, without angiogenesis. But why doesn't the outside keep growing?
Yeah, they keep growing, but there's normal turnover. There's normal turnover cell. Why we don't grow beyond this? Why? I mean, I'm just like it's a size, but I don't grow beyond this. But if there's injury, they'll heal. You know what I mean? It's a homeostasis. They grow, but there's a turnover. And that turnover is shifted towards more growth, more proliferation. You know what I mean?
Okay.
There's a growth. They are growing. The surface of the tumor is growing. But that's not sufficient. Because that grows and there's turnover. So tumor has to break down that turnover, beyond that turnover. For example, if it produces 100 cells per day, that's not sufficient. It has to produce more cells. Because there's death normal process. Even if you culture tumor cells and grow, you know, in culture, they also have normal process. They just divide and grow and die. So that, you know, threshold has to be crossed. That's why this angiogenic switch, that can only be broken if there is active supply of blood vessels. And it's not only if you have a benign tumor. I'll tell you, if you have a benign tumor, even if it grows beyond the limit, and some people are having cysts and they are maybe even benign tumors, but we cannot grade them because they are not having features of a typical tumor, and they are removed. When you have a bump anywhere, you remove that. But what's more dangerous than that bump is invasive. That's only invasive when there is capillary, blood vessel. Because then it can be entering into bloodstream, it can go to secondary sites. That's what how cancer. So benign tumors are the threat. They're not threat. It's only when they grow beyond limit and cross blood vessel, blood barrier, go into streams, and then metastasize anywhere in any body, any place, like any, you know, kidney, lung, or brain. So they grow, but the growth is not sufficient. It is the core, which is hypoxic, and it induces VGF, then it bursts and grows. That's why, you know, see, here I have shown it here. After vascularization, after vascular system is developed, it grows very fast, very fast. And there's a regulation of normal adult tissue, but no regulation of these tumor cells after they attack, you know, these endothelial cells and recruit blood vessels. So this dysplasia after initiation and dysplasia, they are the phases of how a normal cell proceeds through various stages and leads to metastasis. And from the very beginning of dysplasia till metastasis, there is a requirement of angiogenesis. Without it, it cannot go to next step and lead to metastasis. So, for solid tumors to spread and grow, this process is very important. So these are the common features of tumor angiogenesis. There is extreme and chaotic expression of these factors. Because tumor mass after growth, it expresses a lot of angiogenic molecules in abundance. Also, when the tumor vasculature grows, it grows fast compared to normal. And when tumor vasculature grows, it is continual growth. So I told you earlier, reorganization and maturation of vessel. After endothelial cells migrate, they activate, migrate, they make capillaries, they reorganize, they mature, then they rest. But in tumor, there is a continuous growth of these vessels because the tumor grows and grows and grows and is continuous. So they don't have that much time for maturation, because maturation and final organization means that it is going to get rest. But if that rest is not happening, it's continuous, so that maturation is lacking. That's why they are disorganized, low adhesion, and pericytes are less. Pericytes are smooth muscle cells, as I showed in the first slide. They cover the endothelial cells and protect them from harsh conditions. So the tumor vessels are disorganized. They are leaky also. They are also leaky. And there are a lot of changes, hypoxic status, metabolic change, cancer cell introversion, and they don't have any, you know, effects from chemotherapy as well. So this is the basic process of tumor angiogenesis, how a tumor recruits blood vessels and how it grows and what is the mechanism and function. So I have told you already this. So what is the contribution of tumor microenvironment?
how tumor microenvironment is important. You know tumor microenvironment. Tumor microenvironment is like tumor cells and associated tissue. Because if you have a solid tumor, it is not just only cancer cells, tumor cells. It is host tissue also. Host tissue, adhesion molecules, tumor cells, and so many secretory soluble factors. So the tumor cell free, tumor cell or cancer cell free tissue is called as tumor microenvironment. And that's normally from host, normally, mainly from host. And they include macrophages, fibroblasts, myeloid cells, extracellular matrix. And this is rich, this is a rich source of antigenic factors. And they attract the growth of endothelial cells and recruit endothelial, recruit capillaries in the tumor. For example, this is how tissue-associated macrophage induces EGF expression. EGF is epidermal growth factor, and epidermal growth factor is major growth factor in any process in any cell, and it also leads to expression of various genes. For example, it induces AKT activation, ERK activation that lead to endothelial cell survival and proliferation, and also tumor cell survival and proliferation. And TAMs also induce MMPs. MMPs are matrix metalloproteinases. I told you matrix metalloproteinases are important in making endothelial cells move from the origin to the outside, because they degrade the tissue matrix where they are embedded. And they also, these macrophages also activate and release VGF and IL-8. They are the endogenous factors. Then ultimately they affect blood capillary growth and survival. So this is the same mechanism how they are recruited. So this is the basic Judah Folkman, where he published first article in NEJM in 71. He is considered as father of angiogenesis, Judah Folkman. And he supported and he did a lot of research on this aspect and finally formulated angioprevention. So he thought that, and he's a proponent of the theory that if we starve tumor, it will die. And how to starve a tumor? We have to attack its capillary, its vascularization. So vascular targeting is important to inhibiting tumor growth. And it was first done when there was the development of Avastin. Avastin is anti-VGF antibody. And that was developed first, and that led to first successful clinical trials. I will tell you later about the Western. So what are the strategies? How can you inhibit angiogenesis? First of all, this tumor, it secretes these factors, for example VGF, and these factors bind to receptors on the endothelial cells and then lead to formation of capillaries and vessels. So you have to target either the production of these antigenic factors, or you have to neutralize these antigenic factors so that they are not accessible, or they are not in abundance, or they are not ready to bind receptors, or either you have to inhibit the receptors. So all the three strategies are very important. So if you have any question here, you can tell me. This is very important. How the targeting is achieved? These three basic steps in any clinical trial, they follow this. They follow either they inhibit production of these factors, or they inhibit or they neutralize them by binding to antibodies against VGF, or they inhibit their receptors so that they are not available for binding to these factors. So this is same as how these therapies could be targeted, how these could be affected. So first clinically used antigenic therapy was bevacizumab. It's called Avastin trademark. First antibody, and then followed other antibodies, sunitinib, sorafenib, and many people here also, they do, you know, research on these antibodies. Avastin. Bevacizumab, it is the recombinant humanized monoclonal antibody that binds to all isoforms of VHPA, such as KDR, signaling. So it inhibits tyrosine kinase function of this receptor,
after it is affected, KDR is not activated and downstream signaling is all inhibited and it cannot be supporting any future growth of any capillary. And it was developed by genetic biotechnology and it is still in use in clinic. And it was the first success of any angiogenesis drug. Now there are limitations of this therapy targeting angiogenesis, because this therapy can interfere with normal homeostasis. For example, there is wound injury healing. If you use that therapy under such conditions, we cannot, right? Or there is a menstruating female, she will also have problems. So maybe there will be no conceiving or the embryo will die. But it also has off-target effects, because if you use this therapy, because VEGF is not only required for angiogenesis, it's also required for other processes. So it can have off-target effects,
like high blood pressure, bleeding, coronary artery disease, because it is related to capillaries. So obviously these effects will be there. And there will be gastrointestinal perforation, because when we eat and our gut is constantly abrased when we have bowel movement. We eat, and so there is some basal angiogenesis going on. If you target that angiogenesis therapies, that will be effective. So we have to take care of everything. So hemorrhage, neutropenia, it has been seen that in patients giving chemotherapy against angiogenic aspects, the neutrophils are not are screwed up, and if neutrophils are screwed up, there will be no innate immunity activation, and that will lead to immune dysfunction. So now let's move to the metastasis. Angiogenesis and metastasis, they are interlinked. You cannot delink them. So that's why we try to put them together. So what is metastasis? Metastasis basically is when there is a benign tumor, it becomes invasive and it moves from its primary site to secondary site, or from secondary site to tertiary site. For example, a tumor is a primary tumor, grade 1 tumor, for example. It is in any site. Now we do biopsy and then we score it, for example, a prostate tumor, PIN. It's called prostate pre-intraepithelial carcinoma, PIN. Is very initial and it's not that dangerous. But if it is like there, if you don't take care of that and it is tough to diagnose, it's not easy diagnosed, then it will become invasive. After it becomes invasive, invasive means it has the potential to invade. It becomes so invasive it goes into the bloodstream, and after it goes to the bloodstream, it can go to lung, brain or any other tissue. So that's what is called a metastasis. So everybody has a lot of benign tumors, but they are not metastatic, they don't spread. Or some benign tumors, they remain quiescent, latent for rest of life. So only this process makes them malignant and grow in secondary and growth at primary site is always lengthy. It can be decades, it can be lifetime. But growth at secondary sites is very important. And at secondary sites they grow very fast. At primary site they don't grow fast. Maybe the tissue or the host tissue at the primary site is capable of checking the growth of primary tumor. That's why it wants to go to the secondary site. And when the benign tumor becomes invasive, it's not random. The metastatic process is very directive. It's very targeted. So what is the role of host? Because I will show you a slide here. Okay. See the prostate tumor. It can go only to brain, lungs, liver, and bone marrow, and no other organ. No other. That's what I was trying to tell you, that it's directive. It's not random. Pancreas can go to lungs and liver. Breast can go to these tissues. Colon, lungs, liver, and bone marrow. So it's very specific. Colon cannot go to brain. You know what I mean? It's very. Why so? If it goes into bloodstream, why it colonizes only in bone marrow, liver, or lungs? Why not in brain?
So the hay has come up. So hay has come up that the malignant tumor or pre-metastatic tumor, it secretes some factors, pushes them to the bloodstream. They go and they bind their cognitive receptors on the homing sites, where the future specific site is there. They bind to, for example, then there's infection, you know, and for example, infection is in specific lung, neutrophils, other leukocytes, they travel to infection. Why? How? Because when there is initial attack of infection, there is abundance of chemokines go up, and these chemokines become chemoattractant molecules for those cells. They come into size. That's how tumors also induce chemokines, because CCRs, chemokine receptors, are now important aspect of targeting, therapeutic targeting of tumors. So chemokine receptors, many people do research on chemokine receptors because they think that, they assume, and it's true by research, that if we block chemokine receptors, we can block metastatic, you know, progression. So these tumor cells in malignant tumor or invasive carcinoma, they secrete some factors go to bloodstream and they bind cognitive receptors. For example, here, if it goes to bloodstream, I mean the chemokine factors, they can go to anywhere, but they bind only those partners which are compatible. They bind only lungs, liver. After binding here, they reprogram homing. They make the atmosphere, the niche, conducive for the future growth of these colon tumor cells. So homing is very important. So driving force of this is mainly these tumor cells, they secrete factors which make conditions very conducive for any future growth. So metastasis was, you know, studied in prehistoric time, and I won't go through that, you can go through. And how the first experiment, we showed that tumors like cancers are cell-based mechanism of tumor growth, was done by these two guys who developed neural mice, and neural mice are thymic neural mice. They don't have T cell, and any cell which can grow, which in culture can grow here. So tumor cells were implanted and they grew in neural mice, and that gave rise to a cell-based theory of tumor metastasis. This is the first, you know, to go for soil and seed. Seed is the tumor cell and soil is the future site. This is the pre-metastatic niche formation, as I was talking about, how pre-metastatic niche is formed, how the conditions are made conducive in the secondary sites, that tumor cell going there after so many years will thrive, make a secondary metastatic tumor. So this is the, you know, how this is affected. This is primary tumor, this is associated macrophages. They induce these factors, and these factors change the behavior of secondary sites, make them conducive, and then any future tumor cell going into these sites will develop and grow. So what is important here? How tumor cells transfer from primary site to secondary site? They cannot go beyond, you know, a certain shape, because normal cells are like this. They're called epithelial-like cells. Epithelial marking is very important. In this mode, in this shape, cells cannot invade or go to other tissues, neighborhood. Like, if they are epithelial-like, they cannot travel. It's only change in shape leads to invasive. I'll say that there's a process called mesenchymal behavior. So epithelial behavior and mesenchymal behavior. Mesenchymal behavior is cell shape change to this, and this shape is how it can go into the secondary sites. normal hyperplasia, mild dysplasia, and then it becomes only invasive when the epithelial shape totally changed to mesenchymal shape. And in mesenchymal form, the tumor cells are invasive and they can easily move, because movement of tumor cell is important only when they are in the mesenchymal shape. They cannot move like, because they can achieve only amoeboid movements only in this mesenchymal morphology. In epithelial morphology, they cannot move. They are cemented, they are together, they have capacity to aggregate, to grow together. They don't have capacity to move because they cannot leave their niche. But only mesenchymal cells, they have capacity to migrate. I'll show you later how. This is tropism, how different tumors can go to different organs. Okay, this is carcinoma in situ, the benign tumor, and through progression it becomes invasive. How it becomes invasive? When it has the potential to disseminate its tumor cells. The first step of invasion is intravasation into a capillary, a blood vessel. After intravasation, it has to extravasate at the site of its homing. When they extravasate at the site of homing, they first form micrometastasis. So micrometastases remain dormant for many years. They don't grow for many years. They first adjust, they first start seeding there, remaining there. After the conditions become conducive for many years for their growth and progression, they colonize and they become actual micrometastases. This is just organ structure of tissues. This is the cancer cell which has, this is basal lamina, tissue matrix, this is tumor cell, and how they become invasive. This is lamellipode or amoeboid movements, that's how they become invasive, and they move through amoeboid movements through this basal lamina and invade to the capillaries. So the intravasation, the first step, how tumor cells go into the bloodstream from primary site. This is capillary and this is ACM, so they have to go to capillaries. Once lodged in the blood vessel, they have to leave through extravasation. So this is the basic process of extravasation. Once they are in the bloodstream, the platelets surround these tumor cells, and these platelets guide them out of the vessel. Once they guide them out of the vessel, they proliferate and they push and they make tumors in the secondary site. So this is how. Now tumor cells they are not healthy or happy in the bloodstream, because the bloodstream is very harsh for them. In bloodstream they can die. It's not easy. Even though some tumor cells can go into bloodstream, that doesn't guarantee their metastatic progression. They have survived the bloodstream. It's very harsh. The pH is different. And tumor cells they want to grow in less oxygen conditions. They don't like alkalinity. They like acidity. They are having high glomerular rates, and in blood there is normal oxygen concentration. Under normal shear, they don't like that, because tumor cells are having high glycolytic rates, and glycolysis is preferentially recruited by tumor cells because that gives them survival edge. Because there's an effect called a Warburg effect, you might have seen. Yes.
But don't most tumor cells metastasize by lymphatics?
What's that?
Don't most tumors metastasize by lymphatics?
I mean, lymphatics and blood vessels, the same system. They're two aspects of the same system. It's xylem or phloem, a plot system. So lymphatics is related to then only to immune modulation, and the capillaries and the vessels of blood, they are primarily functioning for the food or other things. But they have both capacities.
So tumor cells go through both. So other capillaries, I told you earlier, lymphangiogenesis and angiogenesis and vasculogenesis, they are all same. So there is no difference. So either it is in lymphatics or in blood vessel, it's same. Yeah, then what's that?
The flow of lymphatics is less, right?
But there is flow. That's how immune cells home in lymphatic system, and then after homing, if there is an infection, they go rapidly. They go rapidly. It's not like from the monocytes. When the monocytes, you know, when the infection, monocytes go and it's rapid, and they go and invade the infection site, and then they come out through lymphatics or through bloodstream and become dendritic cells. This is. So, either it's lymphatics or blood capillaries, so it's same. So, tumor cells can go through any other way. So if they can go through either way, they have choice. And the lymphatics and the, you know, this is connected at some point. So, both ways. But here, my point was that even if it is lymphocytes or even if it is capillaries, the conditions are harsh for tumor cells. So, it's not conducive for them. So, they have survived this harsh environment. So many cells go into stream of lymphatics or capillaries that doesn't guarantee their future seeding in homing sites. So my point was here that about the Warburg effect, about the glycolysis. So all tumor cells they have high glycolytic rates, because Warburg effect is giving them survival edge. If they have high glycolysis rates, they will not be using oxygen, mitochondrial pathway. Any tissue, any cell using mitochondrial pathway will ultimately lead to ROS production. And ROS production, reactive oxygen species, that is important for cell death, right? So, tumor cells don't like that, because they don't want to die. They survive more and more. That's why they avoid ROS production through oxygen. So, oxygen and any cell death, majority of cell death are through mitochondria. So mitochondrial cell death is important. So tumor cells avoid mitochondrial cell death. They make their mitochondrial deficient so that they cannot function in oxygen condition. In normal scenario, normal healthy cell, 70% of energy comes from mitochondria and 30% comes from glycolysis. But in tumors, it is 70% from glycolysis and 30% from oxygen. So they shift completely to glycolysis, because they avoid mitochondrial function, because mitochondrial function leads to cell death, because those cells whose mitochondria is very active, they have much turnover, greater turnover, they produce, they die. But those cells which have high glycolytic rates, whose glycolysis is very high, they don't die normally. For example, neurons don't die, right? In adult brain, right? They don't die. You know that they're fixed. They die, but they're fixed, so they don't die normally. They die with their own, they have their long limit till death. Because their energy consumption is mainly through glycolysis. So glycolysis is important there. And glycolysis is shown to induce survival. And my point here was that when they are in bloodstream or lymphatics, as you said, they will be in harsher condition. There is normoxia, there is potential to use oxygen. So they don't like the environment, they want to go as soon as possible to the homing sites. But it's not always successful. The success rate of any tumor cell in the stream is very low. So this part is very tough. So this is actual, you know, vessel, and this is tumor cell. How they look in the real, you know, in vivo. This is GFP labeled vessel and the tumor cells in flowing through. And people do it here. So one, I don't know the name of lab, they do it. They use this system to track trafficking of tumor cells and trafficking of immune cells. See, I was talking about the chemokine regulation. So how chemokines regulate leukocyte recirculation and trafficking to sites of inflammation and infection. Similarly, this is the similar process which is being exploited and followed by tumors also. So to the sites of homing for leukocytes, for inflammatory cells, for immune cells, the site of their choice is infection, because the production of chemokines is high here, and they move towards the signal. Similarly, tumor cells follow same thing, same guidelines. This is entire process of
intravascession, invasive carcinoma, intravascession, extravascession, homing, and metastatic, you know, lesions. Okay, so after now, there is success. For example, okay, now the success rate is low, but now the cell, the tumor cell has finally gone into the secondary site. At secondary site, they first become micrometastases. Few cells, they don't grow, they remain there for maybe months, for years, for decades. It depends on the tumor. They live here for a long time, or maybe medium time, short time, till they become fully functional in adapting to the scenario, adapting to the home, and then they grow fast. So initial colonization, right away after excavation, is called micrometastasis. So this is GFP labeled micrometastasis. We can see here, they are very viable. They seem that they are not viable because they don't grow for a long time, but once they get conditions conducive, they grow beyond limits and become very metastatic. So see the how survival and the presence of micrometastases is important. It is this probability of survival free of micrometastases. So months of, if there is a surgery, so these are okay. First of all, you background of this. This is the actual result, you know, of an experiment. Before this, there's a tumor in a patient, benign tumor, and then biopsy is done and they say it's invasive. Invasive, it has the potential to move to any part, but there are no visible signs of any metastasis. Because micrometastasis, they cannot be detected. They're difficult, even the imaging cannot. Because the first imaging, if you have to locate a tumor inside a patient, what you do first? A clinic, glucose, right? Radioactive glucose is given to the patient. When the patient is fasting for 24 hours and then they give radioactive glucose, as I told you, the tumor preferentially has high glycolytic rates. So they accumulate glucose compared to normal cells. Normal cells don't accumulate glucose because they don't use glucose as a preferential source. It's only 30%. But tumor cells, they entirely 70% of energy from glycolysis. So they use this glycolytic phenomenon. And glucose induction into the system, you can locate a tumor. And if the tumor is benign, you can remove it. But now after biopsy, you find the patient, the clinician finds that it's invasive, and he thinks there might be some micrometastasis anywhere in the body, but he's not sure, or she's not sure, but the patient might have. You don't know. So this is an actual experiment where the patient has been, has undergone a surgery of the benign primary tumor, but it was noted that few micrometastases are there, and then they were followed. So months of surgery and probability of survival free of micrometastases. See, if there are no micrometastases, the survival are more, right? Chances they survive. I mean, this is one is 100%, point is 80%. Almost 90% survival after 48 months. And if there are micrometastases, the survival after 48 months is only, I think, 50%, right? The number of micrometastases going, if there are these lesions, the survival goes down. If there are no lesions of these, the survival goes up. So that's how they are related. So micrometastases are related to survival. Because eventually, after some time, they will give tumors. That's how the patient dies of secondary tumor. So this is intravascular. Now, after tumors go to home in the secondary site, how long they remain there till they give fully functional tumor, which manifests itself. Let's see here. This is breast carcinoma. This is primary tumor. So it has high competence to infiltrate. So, after breast carcinoma induces it becomes, and very shortly it has, it becomes invasive and disseminates to secondary sites. But it takes years to give full blown metastasis. So these micro metastasis here, they remain dormant for a long time in breast carcinoma. See here, in colorectal carcinoma, after initiation of tumor, primary tumor, it takes decades to invade to host site. But after it invades to host site, secondary site, it takes only months to give tumors. So there are two regulatory processes, and they are specific to each tumor. So in breast carcinoma, for example, it is highly invasive, but it takes years to become metastatic after, you know, invasion. But here in colorectal carcinoma, it is otherwise. So this is the sequence of events and how difficult they are. So these two are difficult here: escape and colonization, intravascularization and extravascularization, and homing. They are the difficult ones. So they are, I have listed here metastatic promoting genes which induce metastasis, and people do that. People do microarray, people do gene sequencing, RNA-seq, or they do protein profiling in tumors, and then they see which genes are upregulated, which are downregulated. You can do on proteome analysis. So it's like same. So these are the genes which are promoting metastasis. Yeah, same genes. And these are the genes which are suppressors, tumor suppressors. So which tumor suppressor you know? What is the fulcrum of, this is the fulcrum of tumor suppression. P53, right? You might be knowing that. That is the mostly, highly studied tumor suppressor gene. And that, is called a hub of tumor suppression. But they are also important. P10. P10 mutations are found in prostate cancer. Because I worked on, this, that's why I know. Now the question is, how do cells become invasive? What is the mechanism that cells become invasive? Excuse me. I told you earlier that morphology is important, right? Cells cannot lead a normal progression without breaking those epithelial markers. So epithelial morphology is not stable for migration or invasion. So epithelial morphology has to be taken over by some amoeboid-like features, and amoeboid-like features are called mesenchymal features. So mesenchymal acquisition is very important for any tumor to invade, to grow, to mediate the secondary growth to any site. So the process is called EMT. EMT is epithelial to mesenchymal transition. So now people say that they devise therapies where they induce TME. TME means transition to mesenchymal from epithelial, right? So they do reverse. So there are certain therapies which do reverse. So the basic process is EMT. So this is sea urchin embryo. Why sea urchin embryo? It is very easy to study in lab. So that's why people use that to study EMT process, how epithelial cells change to mesenchymal transition. And why is it important? It's important because if embryo growth, even in the embryo development, is important. Because once embryo grows, then the cells are epithelial, they cannot migrate. Embryo development is intensive process. Migration, invasion is constantly going on. So that's continuous process. So if the cells are not in mesenchymal shape, they cannot migrate, invade to the sites within the embryo, and they cannot grow into an infant. See, these are epithelial cells. They don't have potential to grow, to divide. There's no space. So they make changes, because in embryo there's a lot of changes from within layers. Cells migrate here and there. It's an intensive migratory invasive atmosphere. But these cells cannot migrate, invade to other sites if they remain in the same shape. So they have to be amoeboid-like. they have to make the change to, they have to shift to mesenchymal phenotype. Then they can migrate and then they can become, invasive and replicate. So this is how these cells are here, different than these. They are highly epithelial. And these are mesenchymal, loosely attached, mucoid. And it's easy for a cell to move, to invade, to migrate if they are more like amoeba. See here, inverse cells. They are ready to grow, but they are starting to invade. What are the major changes during epithelial to mesenchymal transition? The major changes are loss of E-chitin. E-chitin is a protein which is important for maintenance of epithelial markers, epithelial phenotype. So epithelial phenotype is mainly governed by E-chitin. So during the invasive process, loss of E-chitin is considered to be a marker. So loss of E-chitin is a marker of invasive carcinoma. That's how clinicians grade tumors, whether they are invasive or not. They look at the phenotype, morphology of the cells, and the first is the structure, and then the marker is E-chitin. The cell shape is, and the cell shape is, okay, this one other class of enzymes called RhoGTPases. They also are important in regulating the cell changes. And RhoGTPases mediate changes in lamellipodia and papillipodia and amoeboid members, the protrusions, the organization of fibrils, myosin actin filaments is governed by RhoGTPases. That's another aspect. So they are important at the actual movement of cell, forming lamellipodia and amoeboid structures, and MMPs. So MMPs, any cell that cannot support MMP expression, MMP is matrix metalloproteinases. So matrix metalloproteinases are important. They degrade surrounding tissue, make cells make path for cells to walk, to go, glide. So they are also important. These three aspects are important. E-chitin, it changes to mesenchymal phenotype. RhoGTPases, it changes the density of fibrils in the lamellipodes, in the millipodes, which are important for movement, gliding movement of amoeboid-like shape. And MMPs, it degrades the surrounding material, makes path very easy and ready. See epithelial structure and how EMT changes into mesenchymal. And these are the features of this. Cell polarity is good. You can see this polarity is no good. This polarity is ordered. They are stationary. E-chitin is high and M-chitin is low. Here it's totally opposite. No cell polarity, E-chitin is loss of E-chitin, and M-chitin is highly expressed in mesenchymal cells. So there are various factors which mediate this process of EMT, and most importantly are their snail, slug and twist. These three proteins are more important. I'll tell you later how they do. So EMT in tumor, how does EMT mediate tumor progression? Like this is a classical example of a tumor progression, right? Normal epithelium, dysplasia. So I have given it in a sequential order, how tumor grows from normal cell to invasive, to intravasate, to micrometastasis, and finally tumor. And how EMT plays an important role. Till dysplasia, see, this is the first normal epithelium, there's no change. After initiation is called an event which makes normal cell into tumor cell, or tumorous phenotype. So then they become dysplasia and adenoma, they start changing shape, they start changing polarity, and they become more and more mesenchymal, and full-blown EMT is here. And when they become EMT-like, their movements have become easy, and they intravasate, then they extravasate, and they then affect micrometastasis and give rise to metastasis. As I told you that, snail, slug and twist, they are important markers of epithelial to mesenchymal transition. You can see that, their cells, some cells are being transfected by a vector which induces twist protein. You can see here. And when twist is high, so there are cells. There are cells, there is no twist, only empty vector. In cells which have been transfected or transduced by a twist encoding gene, so twist is up, protein, you can see N-catenin goes down, beta-catenin goes down. So the twist is a mesenchymal marker. If the high expression of twist leads to mesenchymal marker and it leads to EMT process by down-modulating the epithelial markers. See here, the vimentin, fibronectin, and N-catenin, and SM-actin, they are all features of mesenchymal invasive cells. When twist is high, they are high.
See how MMPs are important. So this is the tissue matrix. The tumor. Now tumor is there. It has invaded to surround tissue. So this surround tissue is here. But it has to cross this tissue matrix. Basal lamina or basin membrane. So it can only degrade this basin membrane when the soluble factors from these cells are secreted. That's called a matrix metalloproteinases. And it has been shown that MMPs are a target of tumor cell invasion. And people have been using MMPs as targets, and there have been clinically available therapies which also target MMPs other than antigenic markers. So MMPs is very important. So this is total signaling, how different cells and tissue matrix in the tumor microenvironment, they lead to EMT, how they mediate. So this same I told you how they. I will tell you detail how snail or slug functions. They inhibit the expression of snail or slug. They inhibit epithelial markers. When epithelial markers are down-modulated, cell becomes mesenchymal and ready to invade. It induces these markers. When they are the markers, then cell is ready to go beyond. And it also, snail slug function, they also, the expression also inhibit proliferation. But they induce cell shape change, cell movements, invasion, and they induce survival. So these two, mesenchymal markers and cell shape changes and invasion, they are important. And that's what they do. Now how GTPases are important. As I told you, GTPases, they modulate the dynamicity of fibers. And dynamicity of fibers at the preceding end of any cell which is moving forward in the laminopody or rhomboid movements, they're important. Because there is when the cell glides, these rho GTPases have to be active. Because the dynamic property of dynamicity of the fibrillar molecules, like when cell moves, the laminopores are getting formed, they are being stopped, they are being formed, new laminopores are formed, then cell attaches and then moves forward. So these laminopores and filipores, they are constantly being made and degraded. So these GTPases are very important in that process. They maintain the dynamicity of these laminopores and filipores. What is the correlation between EMT inducing transcription factors and the malignant behavior in cancer patients? So this is survival. I told you, snail and slug or twist, they induce EMT. They make tumor cells invasive. They make them move beyond their normal position. They move to secondary sites. If snail is low, or there is no snail, the survival is 100% after 5 years. It has been seen. It is the clinical data, actual data, inpatient data. However, if snail is high, see, it goes higher and higher. If snail is high, for example, there is low snail here. The first one, green line, low snail, survival is very huge, very high. Snail is high, it goes down. So there is indirect
correlation between survival and snail expression. Similarly, when TVC is high, the survival goes down. When TVC is low, survival goes beyond. So that means snail and twist, they are pro-EMT molecules, and they are involved in their response for low survival after their high expression. So this is the same process how homing and colonization. So as we discussed earlier, so they are same how pre-invasive stage to metastatic stage, what is the process and how they are delayed, and but how they are moved, and they manifest each and every step. So we discussed all this. Okay, so but we learn all these phenomena today, angiogenesis and how angiogenesis is important tumor development, and how metastasis is affected by angiogenesis, then invasion, migration and EMT process, and also anti-angiogenic therapy, how it is possible to target tumor metastasis by targeting angiogenesis. So these aspects. So we have questions and we can discuss. Yeah, that's it. Any questions, we can discuss.